Yeah, Stephen Cranston. We are in a little small town called Eureka, just out of Hamilton in the Waikato. So this is the heart of the dairy industry in New Zealand.
Tell us about your farm, size of it, and how long you've been here, etc.
This is my second season on this farm. It's just by New Zealand standards, it's probably a smaller one, 60 hectares, 200 cows.
What's
And
that in acres, do you know?
good question. Times 2.4. So yeah, 60 times 2.4, so 130 or 150 or something.
Okay, and so tell us about your daily routine.
Well, at the moment, we're just finished mating. So it's pretty straightforward. Milk the cows, make sure the calves are fed and shifted. And yeah, it's pretty quiet during the day. We do a little bit of maintenance sometimes until afternoon milking around 3 o'clock. So it's nice and easy going at the moment.
So, when it comes to milking, do you need lots of people or is it fairly mechanized, automated, whatever?
It's a one-person farm essentially from this time of year. I get a little bit of help from the farm owner during the calving season, but basically from this time of year on, it's really just me. So yeah, 200 cows is a nice easy operation if it's set up properly.
I mean, is there a reason, particular reason why you got into farming in the first place?
Good question. Well, I was born and raised on a dairy farm. I've always had a passion for farming and the countryside. I've done various other jobs. I've only been literally farming, or on the ground farming for the last 3 years. But I have been in the farming industry as a consultant for 6 years previous to that. So, yeah, I've always had an interest in this space. And yeah, I'll probably move from farming into more of the policy space as time goes on.
Is there a big difference, do you think, between farmers that own their own land and tenant farmers?
Well, yes and no. I guess on a day-to-day basis, probably not. But if you own the farm, you're going to be thinking a lot more longer term about how you do things and how you set things up. Where if you are a lease farmer or a share milker, as we the system we have in New Zealand.
How does that work?
So the main one there is 50-50 share milker. So the farm manager, so to speak, owns the cows and the machinery, and the farm owner just owns the land. But the share milker, they can basically just get on and farm as they see fit. But according to the farm owners, the contract, the general guidelines that farmer sort of expects. So that's a common way to transition from towards farm ownership. You might be a share milker for 10 years or something, build up that equity, and then go out and buy a farm yourself. So that's been a common pathway for New Zealanders to actually get to farm ownership.
So, how big does a farm have to be viable here? I hear in the UK, if you've got less than 100 cows, really it's difficult to make a living as a dairy farmer.
Yeah, well, it's changing all the time. It's a moving target. So farms are definitely getting bigger over time. There was a lot of farms around the Waikato that were around that 40 hectares, so just around 100 acres. That was a common size of farm when they were surveying them out. A lot of those, they need to be pretty good quality farms to actually be viable now. But that's not to say they can't be, but yeah, it's moved more towards, your sort of 300-400 cow herds are probably more typical around the North Island. So yeah, anything under around 150 cows, you don't see very often, and probably less so as time goes on.
So why is that? Is it the costs of the machinery? Is it the costs of labour? Is it the sale of the milk, the price you're getting for the milk?
Yeah, it's just efficiency. So you still have, well, see, I'm a one person labour unit here with 200 cows. I'd still need to be doing all the same jobs with 150 or 120 cows. So there's definite efficiency gains by increasing cow numbers to a point. The other thing that comes in is there's a lot of compliance cost. So a lot of effluent systems were upgraded in New Zealand over the last sort of 10 years. So a lot of these small farms, they sort of have been fine, but then they come to a big new expense that they need. They might need to spend $100,000 on a new effluent system. And that's when a lot of them just decide, okay, we'll just go to dairy support and not continue milking. Or it might be an upgrade of the shed or any big upgrade. When that time comes, a lot of people just decide, well, it's just not worth it.
In the UK, in the winter, the cows go in the shed generally, and then they come out and they sort of leap around the field in the springtime when they're allowed out. Is that the same over here?
Not really. There's a few farms down south which are predominantly indoors, certainly over winter. But no, it's not common at all. And we've got a pretty friendly climate in New Zealand, so cows are quite happy outdoors most of the time. I'd say they prefer it. Although when the weather is really bad, there's certainly a lot of animal shelters, so covered feed pads and that sort of thing. So when we do get really bad weather, there is that infrastructure on some farms where they can stay for a while. But long term, that is tricky because you got to have... It's very expensive to build a barn that cows can actually be in for a long period of time.
Now, look, if you talk to anyone really in the UK about New Zealand, they think of New Zealand lamb, they think of sheep farming. But that doesn't seem to be... Driving around, it seems to be a lot more cattle than sheep.
Well, certainly around the Waikato. There used to be a bit of sheep country around here, but just the economics of dairy versus sheep, there was a big shift to dairy about 15, 20 years ago. The sheep numbers are slowly dwindling. Now their biggest challenge is pine trees with carbon farming, which is another real disaster happening in New Zealand at the moment.
Farmers, it's not a disaster. It's actually quite a good income, isn't it, if they're being paid to plant trees?
You can argue that. You can argue that the economics... it's just there's far more profit in farming carbon, I guess, than farming sheep and beef on a lot of the hill country of New Zealand now. So it's not typically the actual farmers that would be doing that. They might plant a few sections of their farm. That's certainly happening. But what's really the concern for New Zealanders at the moment is whole farms, like magnificent sheep and beef stations, are just being bought up by sometimes overseas interests, sometimes New Zealand companies, and are just planting the whole thing in pine trees. And that's just absolutely destroying rural communities at the moment. That's good food producing land, and it's just going to be planted in pine trees, the gate shut, and that land will be used for nothing else other than pine trees for the next sort of 100 years.
I mean, some will say, well, that's great because it's less work, and actually it's almost an arable crop, planting pine trees. You probably couldn't quite say that for cowries that take like a 1,500 years to mature. But, I mean, you know, for a lot of people who are into forests, this is just another crop, really. It's just that it takes longer to grow.
Yeah, well, pine trees aren't really the... If you're thinking about carbon storage, pine trees aren't really the ideal anyway. They're not a long-lived tree. Certainly in New Zealand, once they get to around 50, 70 years old, they start sort of breaking down and they become a fire hazard. So we're planting all these Pinus radiata forests around New Zealand, which at some point are going to die back, and that's going to be a real disaster for future generations. I've got nothing against the concept of carbon farming if it's done in a considered way, but it's certainly the way it's happening at the moment is not right, and I'd be liking to see a lot more native plants used that can actually live for another 500, 1,000 years. That's where I think it should go for long-term carbon storage.
I don't know. Are there actually... Do they grow cows? I mean, the cowries are, for people that don't know, is a very long-lived and massive tree, which when the English first turned up in New Zealand, they spent decades farming these trees, basically, and then shipping them abroad. But they're like, in a way, like a sort of giant redwood tree of this part of the world that takes... Mm. Like 1,000 or thousands of years to grow to maturity, Is that is anybody actually growing these massive long-term trees? It's like the old Indian saying, you know, you've got to look in 27 generations' time. Well, if you're doing that, you're not going to plant a pine tree. You're going to plant a kauri, surely.
Yeah, well, kauri was certainly a magnificent tree. I think they're the second largest tree in the world by volume after the giant redwood. But that's not probably the ideal tree you would plant for that because they are so slow growing. But we have some quite fast growing natives too. From this area north is the totara. That grows quite rapidly. It's almost a weed in a lot of places. So it's these sort of trees that really thrive and are suited to the environment and will live long term and actually provide an ecological and biodiversity benefit as well. Pine trees are quite a negative. They got toxic needles keeps down a lot of the understory and undergrowth from growing. So, yeah, I don't think they're the ideal sort of plant to be growing for this.
I love the kauri. It's a beautiful tree. Anyway, you've started there talking about carbon, right? Now, yeah. When was it farmers started to have to think about carbon? Because, I mean, certainly we heard about this, I mean, probably a decade ago, as something where we have to watch out for all the carbon being thrown out of exhaust pipes of cars and aircraft and things like that. But to me, it's a completely new idea that the farmers have got to be concerned about this carbon too.
Yeah, well, it is very new. I guess it's been on the radar. They tried, I couldn't tell you what year it is, they tried to bring in the fart tax, they called it. That was a good decade ago at least. So it's been there.
But they failed with that. It's just the New Zealand government, yeah?
Yeah, there's a couple of farmers drove a tractor up onto the steps of Parliament and waved lots of signs around. And yeah, the government gave up. There was a massive pushback. So I guess I've been sitting and thinking about how they're going to get this over the line for all the in-between years, I guess. And yeah, it's really just the last sort of 3 years where the rubber's really hit the road with, you know, the government seriously turning this farming emissions pricing into a reality. So that has been in the pipeline for the last 3 years through a collaboration called He Waka E Kanawa. And yeah, that's causing a massive, there's a lot of disillusionment with what they've come up with. And the more people are actually starting to understand, the reality is actually starting to sink in for the government that it's not actually as straightforward and as simple as what they sort of have been telling the public, right. Really.
I mean, it's likely to put up food prices, any kind of tax on farming. It's also an important export, surely, for New Zealand to be exporting food.
Well, exactly. And the current proposals talking about reducing sheep and beef profitability by 20%. So I can imagine any farmers anywhere in the world, if the government's just going to tell you we're going to take 20% of your profits and, you know, 15, 20% of you are going to be out of business in a few years, you know, people are obviously pushing back against that. And yeah, it's going to increase food prices, which just seems and food supply at a time in the world where we're really needing to produce more food. There's a real scarcity issue in some areas. And in New Zealand, we have, because we are very efficient with our farm systems, our pasture-based system is incredibly efficient from an emissions perspective. So
hang on. What, from an emissions perspective, what do you mean? I find it strange that a cow eating grass should be considered to be producing emissions, because whatever emissions it's producing is surely coming from the grass itself.
Yeah.
Or breathing the air, you know, what is causing this so-called, you know, pollution? Effectively, that's what they're trying to say, is that cows cause pollution.
I wouldn't call it pollution. I think that's the politics, not the science. CO2 is plant food. We all know that we need that. There wouldn't be life on Earth without CO2. So the fact it's getting demonised, that's just politics. There's no real logic behind that. But look, there are emissions. There are greenhouse gases. I guess the real issue with agriculture is what effect are those greenhouse gases actually having? So if you look at a farm, 80% of our total emissions are methane. And everyone's making a real big deal about that. But if those emissions are stabilised over a period of time, it doesn't actually add to additional warming. So that's to say you keep your stock numbers relatively the same and you don't increase your production. And I'd say a lot of farms around the world and back in the UK and Europe, a lot of farms are just sort of at the status quo. So over time, those farms are not adding to additional warming from methane, and that part's not well understood by a lot of policymakers.
I mean, hang on, because surely sheep and cows have been farting for thousands of years.
Well, yeah, you can take another step back and sort of say that, you know, there's always been ruminants on Earth and they're not driving the a change in the climate. And that's a very logical argument too. How many politicians are listening to that argument, I don't know. But I guess the strongest, where the New Zealand farming community is really pushing back at the moment, is just on the science. We're trying to get our politicians to actually acknowledge the science in the IPCC. So, and we've been asking politicians for evidence or data on what effect agriculture is actually having on climate, and none of them have any. So that's actually quite interesting. They're getting ahead of themselves with the policy, and they haven't actually done their homework on the actual warming effect of agriculture. And I think that's probably where they're the weakest, because this is science, this is what we can actually really prove, and prove that they got this wrong.
Okay, so what are they planning? What are they doing? And what things are going to be taxed? Is it literally per cow or something?
Yeah, so you basically, each farm would do an emissions budget. And you're basically paying for your methane and nitrous oxide total for the farm. And there's a price that goes along with that. So it's not, for the dairy industry, it's going to be quite costly. Maybe $20,000-$30,000 for a typical sort of farm.
How does that break down between the two? So we're talking about here cow farts for the methane. What about the nitrous oxide?
So in a farm system, roughly 80% is methane. That's the big one. And like I said before, that doesn't actually add to warming. So that's a bit of a beat up. Nitrous oxide is a long-term gas. So that would, if it wasn't offset, that would be contributing to warming in theory.
Where does actually nitrous oxide come from?
A lot of it's from cow urine, fertilizer, soils, it's that sort of thing. So the methane's from the ruminant, from the cow, and the nitrous oxide is more fertilizer and urine.
Well, that is interesting because, I mean, certainly back in the 1950s and 60s, some farms in the UK, they didn't actually use any fertilizers at all. They just used the slurry from the cows to, in fact, even on some of the arable parts of the land, that it was all of the fertilizer in terms of slurry, that's basically cow shit, you know, was put up back onto the land. And so there was no inputs, and that they loved doing this because it meant that they didn't have to buy anything. All of what they needed for the farm was produced on the farm itself.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. It's and that's the big difference with agriculture. And they look at a lot of these emissions from, you know, let's say a fuel industry or producing oil or gas or something. Those emissions are quite different to being in agriculture, where it's a cycle. So we've got plants constantly sort of absorbing those emissions and everything over time. So yeah, you're right. If you've got a natural cycle and you're not increasing your cow numbers, you're just staying the way you are, you're really not having an effect. The nitrous oxide, you could argue, because those emissions are long-lived. And if you're converting something from like a plant to nitrous oxide, that is an increase in, I guess, warming effect. So that's the only one. But we also have 2 million hectares of woody vegetation in New Zealand, and our argument here is, well, we've got enough trees to actually offset this nitrous oxide. So you get your accounting right if you're going to point the finger at us.
Well, I know. I've just come down from the Coromandel. It seems to be 90% bush out there. It's almost like, well, there isn't really any farming much. There are a few trees and that sort of thing. So anyway, what about land prices? Because I know certainly in Wales, the private equity firms are snapping up land at the moment. They have these private equity carbon offset companies, which are paid by people like the train operating companies and the rail track who run the railways. They say, well, we're using all this you know, fossil fuel for our job. And so we are paying a carbon offset private equity firm to plant trees. And so this surely is having an effect on the price of land here too, if people are buying up farmland.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what's happening. So there's a few problems with that. There's the idea that we're just continuing to... So a lot of these companies, instead of reducing emissions themselves, it's cheaper just, oh, we'll go buy a farm and plant trees. And that is sort of where we're at now in the New Zealand carbon market. And we've got... A lot of other countries don't have this, but we're allowed to offset 100%. Companies can offset 100% of their emissions with carbon offsets. In a lot of other countries, it's only 10 or 20%. So that's why it's really just getting out of control here. And planting pine trees, with the way the carbon price is around $86, I think, per tonne at the moment, that just blows farming out of the water. It's probably three or four times more profitable now. So that's the risk. But there's a catch with that. And the carbon farming relies entirely on government policy to sustain itself. And if there's a change in government policy, those carbon farms may be unviable. So that is, it's a little bit of a house of cards. And there's a lot of pushback, and I can see a time when there will actually be a change in policy. And then what becomes of these carbon farms? Can they afford to pay the debt on a purchase they paid $60 million for? And I think this is going to be a big topic at the next election because, you know, producing food, that's part of the productive economy. That's genuine market-based production. Carbon farming, that's policy-based business model.
Well, it's also, it's a market, isn't it? This is a market solution that they're trying to come out with. I mean, you know, back in the old days, these sorts of things were prescribed by policy, say, where we want to have more forests, where we'll set up something called the Forestry Commission we did in the UK, and they started growing trees because they'd run out of wood, starting to run out of wood. But, I mean, this seems like it's a real worry for a lot of farmers, even not everyone understands what's going on, and certainly the science behind it hasn't, a lot aren't convinced of it, and maybe even some of them think, well, they're never going to follow this through, they can't carry on with it. We've got a long history of farming on this planet. It's something like 3000 BC. Farmers decided, well, we've got a bit of a surplus now, and that was the beginnings, the seeds of civilization. Without a surplus, the rest of society can't happen.
Oh, that was the, was it the agricultural revolution or whatever? Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. Yeah, just, I guess you got to separate out the free market with government incentivization. So the big claim at the moment is carbon farming is a market or free market system to or solution.
So these are the tree growers, basically, that they've got a carbon farm where they're being paid to grow carbon.
Yeah, so the government's trying to say that that is a market-based solution, but the government is artificially creating that market. That market is entirely based on government policy, not what people want. It's not people need these credits to do a certain thing. It's the government's telling people you need these credits to do a certain thing. So that's the difference. And if that policy changes, the entire business model can collapse. And what does that mean for these farms in the longer term?
Okay, well, going back to nitrogen dioxide, am I right? It's nitrogen dioxide?
Nitrous oxide.
Nitrous oxide. Okay, I thought that was something you put in cars to make them go faster. But anyway, is that arable farmers then that are having to pay that because they're using fertilizer to grow those crops?
Yeah, so arable farmers, anyone who puts fertiliser on will have a small amount of nitrous oxide. And like I say, it's about 18-19% of a typical sheep and beef or dairy farm as well. So, yeah, it is part of the mix.
Okay, so this new policy being brought in here, is it going to affect exports?
Oh, definitely. Well, they're looking at reducing... our sheep and beef production by around 20% and dairy by 6%. So I forget the exact numbers off the top of my head, but that's a couple of billion dollars of lost exports from New Zealand, and the flow-on effect from that in rural communities is just amplifies it. So it's going to have a major effect on our rural economy over time. But, you know, I guess good for other countries. If we're that silly to shoot ourselves in the foot like this, other countries are going to benefit.
So at the same time all this is happening, we've got the increase of fuel prices, of diesel, petrol, all these kinds of things. Now, obviously, farms nowadays don't use horses. And they don't actually use much labour. As you've said, this is a one-man farm you're on here. Doesn't that also have a big knock-on effect on farming?
Yeah, the fuel costs are quite significant. Fertiliser has been a big one. Oh, yeah. So nitrogen fertiliser that we use quite a bit of in our...
Gas is used, gas prices have gone up and gas is used in fertiliser production.
Yes, correct, yeah. So, yeah, that's really increased in recent times. Fuel, that's, you know, we use, like on this farm in particular, we don't use that much fuel, but every time we get a lot of contractors in to do our silage and cropping and trucking, every time you truck something, all those prices are going up. So agricultural inflation, it was running up above 10%, I think, at the last time they checked. So it's like food prices are pretty good at the moment. So like the dairy price is reasonably good and meat prices are okay. But the on-farm costs are actually increasing equally fast. And if those food prices start dropping, those on-farm costs aren't going to. So there could be a real crunch point if prices don't continue to rise.
What about the vegan agenda? Because a lot of people are saying, well, actually, this is really about just reducing the number of or the availability of meat. In the UK, for example, the Guardian columnist George Monbiot, who I used to work with in Oxford, by the way, he has been saying that actually we can just grow this meat in laboratories, and it's a lot more... Well, it's not necessarily going to taste very different or better or worse, but there's none of the pain and anguish of the slaughterhouse when it comes to growing meat in a lab.
Yeah, well, to be honest, synthetic proteins was a big concern of mine, and that's something that I guess a lot of New Zealand farmers were sort of... wary of how that all develops going forward. But yeah, I think the shine is really starting to wear off that, though, to be honest. Just in recent months, you look at the Beyond Meat share price, that's absolutely crashed. Mm. People are just working out that these aren't good products. They don't like the taste of them. They're not that nutritious. And the whole fad around or the anti-farming campaign, hopefully that's reached the high watermark and is starting to recede. And that's, going back to what I was saying before around how the methane emissions and our actual effect on climate has been misrepresented. That's a real opportunity for agriculture globally to really rebrand ourselves as actually we're a lot more climate friendly than we're giving ourselves credit for or other people sort of accuse us of. And if we start bringing this back to what warming effects, what effect are we having on atmospheric warming, farming's actually very sustainable.
And well, look, hang on, because you've got an increase in the number of vegans and vegetarians out there. Surely the whole tide is turning against livestock farming.
Well, look, I don't know. I don't follow the vegan numbers specifically, but I think that is probably reaching a high tide mark. People go vegan for a while, then they get sick. I hear this all the time. Okay, I've got this iron deficiency or that, and then I think, I don't know if that's going to last long term because it's just not a well-balanced diet is always the way forward, I think. And I don't think it's that easy to find a genuine replacement for naturally produced dairy products and meat. So I'm not as convinced now as maybe what I sort of feared earlier on.
There's quite a few people out there, maybe even more mainstream people that do eat meat, that maybe if they were to see what happens in the slaughterhouse, they would like to do away. I can remember back in the 1980s, the Channel 4 in the UK had a banned season on for a couple of weeks, which was all banned films back when Channel 4 was worth watching. And they had two or three films on there, documentaries about what happens inside the slaughterhouse. Now, if people were to know what happened in there, they possibly wouldn't be buying so much meat.
Oh, well, it depends where you source your meat from, I think. In a lot of foreign countries with lower standards, I certainly wouldn't want to go into their slaughterhouses. I've seen enough on different documentaries and that sort of thing. But, you know, in Europe and the likes of New Zealand and Australia, we've got very high standards as far as care for animals and sort of cleanness and all that sort of thing. I don't, you know, at the end of the day, we eat food. At one stage, it was the farmer used to go out and kill the animal himself, and it was all sort of living off the land. And I think, you know, we've sort of got away from that and just sort of think, oh, food comes from the supermarket now. So I do think we need to be a little bit realistic about what food is and not sort of, and just accept that. But no, I don't think, you know, there's any real animal welfare issues or anything in the sort of more advanced food systems.
What about the whole idea of, I mean, there's obviously genetic modification going on when it comes to the lab-grown meat. I mean, there is a big push to say, well, actually, look, lab-grown meat can take over from all these livestock farms. I'm not personally convinced of that. But is there an anti-genetic modification lobby much in? It almost seems to be forgotten about. There was this whole thing in the 1990s and the noughties about Frankenstein foods. Do we really want to genetically modify plants? Do we want to genetically modify animals to make them more productive? And in the past, you know, there's been all sorts of breeding techniques which have been used to increase production, but not this going in and actually changing the genetic makeup. And I wonder, is there a sort of campaign or whatever in New Zealand? Are people still aware that this is on the cards for lab-grown meat?
Yeah, well, the whole GE conversation, I think, is going to come back, and it's actually going to be emissions reduction that's probably going to prompt that conversation. So New Zealand, historically, we've always been nuclear-free, and GE-free has been another one of our sort of taglines. I don't know if it's always been that well thought through, but that's the position a lot of the more green end of the political spectrum have taken, and no one's really challenged them on that. But I guess the Greens now are in a bit of a tricky situation because they obsess over climate change, but the likes of genetic engineering can actually offer some solutions. So they need to sort of reassess their position and decide which one's more important. And there's not going to be any silver bullets around climate change or emissions with genetic engineering, but there could be small gains, and some of those can just be around drought tolerance or having grass that grows faster or can thrive in a more difficult conditions. And all this actually just helps farm efficiency. So I think it's a conversation that's worthy of, another round, to be honest.
You're right. People see New Zealand as somewhere that's been against genetic modification, genetic engineering, and also nuclear. Is nuclear on the cards over here, do you think, now?
I very much doubt that. Certainly not with this government. And look, we're a pretty small country. The economics of having a nuclear power station are probably not that flash for us. We've got incredible resources with water and I guess wind and solar, although I don't think those are that efficient. So no, I don't think that would be a practical solution for little old New Zealand. But you never know. In 50 years' time, the technology may have got to a point where it is on the cards.
I see these like underground steam. Is it hot underground steam fired power station? I've seen a couple of those driven past where there's a power station and there's loads of steam pouring out the top of it, and it's not a coal fired power station, it's something to do with hot water underground.
Yeah, so there's, if you go around Rotorua, which is a very volcanic area, yeah, it's quite, that's just making the most of the natural environment, really. They've tapped into some of these underground sort of thermal vents, and they use that to power stations. So, yeah, we've got a couple of those, three or four of those, I think. So, yeah, it's just something New Zealand does differently. I think Iceland do quite a bit of that as well.
Now, look, at the moment, you've got the Labour Party in charge with Jacinda Ardern actually winning quite a good majority in the last election, getting back in. This is a ringing endorsement, surely, from the New Zealand public of her. And so that's maybe why she's thinking, well, let's bring in some of these more green policies.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting election. She certainly, I think it was the first outright majority New Zealand's had since we changed the electoral system to MMP. So, yeah, it certainly was a clear mandate at the time. It was, we were in the middle of COVID, of course, too, and there was a lot of fear around that, and she ran a very strong campaign on those issues. I'd say the general mood towards the government at the moment is very different. There's a lot of areas now that where the wheels are just really coming off, whether it's health, education, crime, and all the resentment that's building up in the rural communities now with just all these costs and this new farming tax that they're trying to push. So, yeah, there's a big pushback against this government. I think more than likely there's going to be a change of government. But how different they will be, that's probably the biggest question to look at.
This is one of the worries, isn't it, I think, for anybody, is, well, you vote at an election, but nothing changes quite a lot of the time.
Yeah, and that's a big... So the other main political party here is the National Party, and they're a little bit Labour-light in a lot of ways. They talk a good game, so they're out there saying that, you know, back farmers like they back the All Blacks, and you know, we stand with farmers, and all this sort of good talk. But at the end of the day, they're quite happy to put forward a farming tax which is almost identical to the government's. So there's a big difference there in the rhetoric to what they would actually do. And a lot of the Labour, I guess this government sort of sees the writing on the wall at the moment, so they're pushing through policy as fast as they can before the next election. And yeah, how much of that National would actually repeal? There's a big question over that. They might not like it, but they might not do much about it either.
Now, I notice over the last few weeks, we're talking in month of November 2022, whilst the COP27 summit is going on over in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt with, I believe, there's actually tens of thousands of people attending for 2 weeks over there. Most of them, of course, flying in their jets. I wonder quite how much carbon they're generating by all getting together. Maybe it'd be nice if there was a little bit... as much enthusiasm for the new United Nations General Assembly trying to sort out the Ukraine war and the Yemen war and the various other conflicts around the planet. But her poll rating's going down at the moment quite considerably, very quickly. I'd be interested to know why that is. And I noticed just today she has come out attacking the banks, saying we're going to have to have some sort of, well, suggesting maybe that they'll put a windfall tax on bank profits. Now, that's obviously going to resonate with the public.
Yeah, well, this is what's going to happen. It's sort of that populist stuff that'll come through, and anyone who's making money, and when other people are under pressure and really feeling the cost of living, I guess it's good politics, and that's what her supporters sort of expect. So, yeah, it's a long way to go to the next election, and it's certainly not a certainty. There's certainly a big mood shift, but there's a lot of more money that she could throw around too, and to sort of win those votes back. You know, that happens in the last year before an election as well. So we'll have to wait and see.
So look, you know, what to what extent are New Zealand farmers mobilised though? Are prepared to do something about these proposed changes, eating into their profitability, eating into the supply of land for farming? Are New Zealand farmers prepared to hop on their tractors and go and do something?
Oh, well, we've been doing that. I'm a member of Groundswell New Zealand, and they've led, much like in other parts of the world, in Holland and in other countries. Yeah, they've been taken to the streets and tractors and big signs and really getting the message out. And that's likely going to increase. There's, you know, farmers have also got to keep the farm running too, so it's not always that easy to just jump in a tractor and drive up to the Auckland Harbour Bridge and whatever, but it is really getting the message out. And I guess the big shift that's happened is the majority of the New Zealand public now actually really sympathise with farmers and really understand how difficult it is now with all these regulations and new potential emissions taxes. And I think there was a feeling in political circles that, you know, the rural community is quite a small voting block, and they sort of thought, oh, well, we'll keep all the urban voters happy and sort of target the farmers and we'll be fine. But actually, a lot of urban people really support the farmers as well and can see that this is going to affect their food prices and just make New Zealand worse off economically. So that's the political equation has changed a little bit, and that's a lot of that's to do with the excellent campaigning that Lights of Groundswell have done.
Do you think it'll make a difference?
I actually do. Well, the argument's against this farming tax.
You said already, didn't you, that the previous tax, whatever it was, 10 years ago, the farmers changed the policy.
Yeah, so they backed off then. The whole climate change movement has progressed and just got more intense since then. So there's a lot more pressure on this government to actually make something stick. And they've sort of put a line in the sand saying that, you know, there will be a farming tax. So it's certainly going to come to a head. But the problem the government has, they had the industry groups. So in New Zealand, we have sort of levy bodies, I guess, that are farmer good organisations like Dairy NZ, Beef and Lamb and Federated Farmers. Now, these are lobby groups or advocacy groups that stand up for farmers, or in theory they're meant to. And they've been right behind the government's proposed farming tax sort of all the way through. They've sort of been led along, and they'll do quite nicely out of it through research funding and that sort of thing. So the government sort of thought they'd be able to get this through with quote-unquote industry support. But that's starting to change now. So these groups are under massive pressure. We've got a vote of no confidence potentially coming up for Beef and Lamb. Federated Farmers could face a big loss of subscriptions. They're a subscription-based organisation. So these groups are under intense pressure to actually stand up to government and start representing farmers' views. And once the government loses that industry support, I see that as a major turning point. And that's then you've got the National Party, which will just follow along with whatever the industry groups say. They don't have any real positions on this. They're sort of blowing in the wind a little bit. But if the industry groups really push back or put an alternative proposal forward that's a lot less sort of damaging, maybe, that could get big political support from the likes of the National Party and other opposition parties, and that could change the whole dynamic. So, yeah, I think there will be a change, but exactly what is landed on, I couldn't say.
So, in a nutshell, for a layman looking at this, saying, well, actually, these farms are contributing to global warming, how would you explain the science?
In a nutshell,
80% of a farm's emissions are methane. If you keep those emissions stable by keeping your animal numbers and production stable, there will be no additional warming from that methane. And the other part is nitrous oxide, which is around 20%. And if you can offset that with on-farm trees and that sort of thing, then you get to the point where there's actually no effect on climate whatsoever. And that's where the New Zealand agricultural industry is at. Doesn't mean every individual farm is at that point, but on average across the industry, I would say we're actually climate neutral. And I'd really like to see some modelling on this, but we've asked the government and they don't want to do this modelling, which is quite curious.
Okay, so take a step back from all of this. What do you think is really behind these increased taxes?
Well, it's just politics, and I guess it's come, you got to say it's come right from the top. So the IPCC, you know, they've sort of pushed back on, you know, farming and a lot of that sort of thing, and then our government gets its cues from there, and they sort of, I guess, see that there's it's what their voters want to hear. So yeah, there has been quite an ongoing campaign for a number of years towards taxing farmers and making farmers accountable for their emissions, so to speak, because in New Zealand agriculture is 56% of our country's total emissions, so we've had a big target on our back for a long time. And what we're really trying to say is, well, let's actually get to the science. What's the actual warming effect of those emissions? And that's a conversation that the government doesn't want to have, because yeah, they've got the numbers that suit their politics at the moment, and they don't really want to look at anything else. And that's what's causing all this, all these ructions at the moment. We're just, at no common ground, I guess.
Well, look, if the New Zealand government really wanted to do something about global warming, climate change, surely the first thing to do would be to get its army and its navy together and invade China.
You're saying New Zealand should invade China? Not sure how that would go, actually. Quite badly, I suspect.
Well, but you know, the point I'm making is that actually the great industrial powerhouse of the planet right now is not the United States or the UK. It's actually China. And the emissions coming from New Zealand are piffling compared.
Well, that's exactly right. And it actually it brings up the other point around, it's actually consumption that drives emissions. So I know the Europeans fell into that trap too. They thought, oh, we'll just export all our production, all our factories. You know, we'll just make China do it all for us, and it makes us look much better. But, you know, the EU hasn't really reduced consumption. They still want a new car, the new iPhone, the holiday. That's what's every time you buy an item or do something, it has emissions associated with it. So, but no one's prepared to have that conversation, because everyone wants their highest standard of living. And it's basically just virtue signaling. And we're doing the same here. You know, we'll shut down oil and gas mining in New Zealand, but we'll import coal from Indonesia, which we're doing at record amounts at the moment. So it's, none of it really adds up, and it's all just politics and trying to keep a noisy minority of climate activists happy. And it's really distorting the conversation.
You know, you've just brought back my early, you know, I suppose I was, how old, 10, 11, 12 years old, and the first and the second miners' strikes in England, where we closed down all these deep mine coal pits, sacked tens of thousands of miners, and then brought all our coal in from abroad. And we do exactly the same, of course, with oil and gas.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what's going on. So any of these real climate-focused politicians that really wanted to reduce their country's footprint, why don't they stand up and say, stop buying stuff, stop consuming? Because that's the only thing that will actually reduce emissions. Not that I agree that that's a sensible thing to do, but that's, if someone really wanted to reduce emissions, that's what they'd be saying. But they're not, because everyone would just tell them to bugger off. So, and that's the thing. That's why it's all this virtue signaling and you know, pretending to do something but not really. Like, look at Australia, for example. They have, you know, you got states like South Australia, which have goals to have, you know, a lot of wind turbines for their power and that sort of thing. But they, how many million tons of coal do they export every year? If Australia had any concern, or if they genuinely believed that there was this climate emergency, they would not be digging up that coal. They'd be leaving that coal in the ground. But they're more than happy to send that to China to produce all these you know, goods. So you got to say, you know, like, instead of just messing around with these small little things, why don't they take on the big issues? But no one's prepared to.
What about on the farm? Could you have, say, for example, an electric tractor?
That technology is nowhere close. You can have an electric motorbike, I believe, at this stage. I'm not sure how good they are. I haven't seen too many around. But no, there's generally no other options. And that's the other silly thing about a lot of these you know, like they bought in a, we call it a ute tax, so SUV tax. So a lot of farmers and builders have a four-wheel drive utility vehicle to get around. So that now has a tax when you purchase it, and that money goes towards subsidising someone else to buy a hybrid or an electric vehicle. But what is that builder or farmer meant to do? There's no other options. So if they still want to be a builder or a farmer, they need a suitable vehicle. And that's where the policy's got ahead of the actual, you know, what's even available. So you just got to pay the tax with no other option. So it doesn't change behaviour, it just costs more.
Well, just as a warning to people thinking of buying electric vehicles, check the guarantee on your battery of your vehicle and also the replacement cost for the battery of your vehicle. I mean, you're talking about something like in the UK money, £15,000 or New Zealand dollars, 30,000 New Zealand dollars to replace a battery. And some of the guarantees now are only 5 or 7 years.
Yeah, well, that's a big concern. The other one here in New Zealand is where are all these batteries going to go? Like, it's a relatively new technology at the moment. Give it another 10 years where these a lot of these batteries are starting to fail. How are they disposed of? And we're also pretty much at the peak capacity of our electrical grid at the moment too. So yeah, once we start plugging all these cars in, what happens there? And I don't think anyone's really thinking that far ahead. I think the technology's there, but it's one of those things, when it's good enough and everything's going to work, people will do it anyway. It's when you got government incentives sort of forcing everyone towards this stuff, when the infrastructure and everything's not quite there or being thought through, that's when you get real adverse outcomes.
Well, this is one of the nice easy things about England and New Zealand, or Britain and New Zealand, is that you basically double the number of pounds and you get New Zealand dollars roughly. Can you just give us an idea as a dairy farmer, you know, what price are you getting for your milk when you sell it wholesale, and what price it is in the shops? Because I think anyone listening who's involved in the dairy industry in the UK would be quite interested, because we're constantly told that the price that farmers are getting from the wholesalers, from the supermarkets, where it's actually largely the wholesalers that sell to the supermarkets, and that's quite a monopolised trade in itself. I'd be interested to know the figures for over here.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tricky conversion, and I used to have this conversation a bit when I was in the UK and Ireland. So we get paid on milk solids, because a lot of our milk is evaporated and turned into other products rather than sold directly to shops. So it's around $9 to $10 per kilogram of milk solids. So per litre, you'd have to times that by around 11. Or divide it by 11, is it?
Say 10.
It's 10, yeah. It might be around $1 a litre, something like that, is what we get paid at the farm gate. A bottle of milk, 2 litre milk, might be sort of $5, so that's $2.50 a litre.
Right, so can you just wind up, Steve, by telling us something about the political landscape of the pressure groups here in New Zealand, and you know, what kind of organisations are looking out for farmers, and also on other issues around the country maybe that are related to what's going on here?
Yeah, well, the political landscape, it's really been, this climate tax has really brought rural sort of advocacy and representation to a fore. It's been really hotly contested. There's quite a split, a lot of infighting, I guess, and it's pretty intense between sort of farmers that think, oh, we need to do as we're told, and there's a lot of other farmers that are sort of, hey, don't tell us what to do, you know, get the science right. So,
some people will be pointing at you and saying, well, hang on, you're just trying to slow down this inevitable change, and also you don't like the environment. That's what they'll be saying to you.
Oh, I'm sure they do, and there's a lot of misinformation out there too. So Groundswell is one of the big, the main sort of protest group against this. And a lot of people get that first impression of Groundswell, but you actually dig a bit deeper, and the people that created it did it because they actually wanted to get better environmental outcomes, and found that a lot of the regulations were actually making things harder to improve the environment. So we're actually promoting a lot of on-farm farm actions and practical solutions to improving water quality and biodiversity and that sort of thing. And it's often the regulations which actually get in the way of that. And it's all this extra cost. So if you have to spend $10,000 on compliance, well, that's $10,000 you're not going to spend on buying shrubs to plant around your waterways, isn't it? So this is where a lot of the thinking from Groundswell is coming from. It's not anti-environment by any stretch. It's let's look at actually achieving something rather than just making rules around it.
Okay, Steve Cranston, dairy farmer at Eureka near Hamilton in New Zealand. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good to chat.